Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. On Memorial Day, and Memorial Day this year falls on what would have been President John F. Kennedy's 100th birthday. So we start the show with our recent interview with historian Douglas Brinkley and Stephen Kennedy Smith, nephew of President John F. Kennedy, to talk about JFK. We will also hear from our Green Space interview with historian David McCullough on taking the long view on the fraught current moment. Then my recent talk with On the Media's Brooke Gladstone about her oh-so-timely new book. And we'll finish up with the inimitable John Waters and his advice for college graduates or anyone wanting to create. So whether you're observing Memorial Day, JFK's 100th birthday today, or the unofficial start of summer, I hope you enjoy. Here are a few of JFK's own words to kick it off. This is from his Democratic Convention speech, accepting the nomination for president in 1960, sounding the theme of hope and renewal that he was maybe the best known for. Listen in this how he is not reverential about tradition.
It is time, in short, for a new generation of leadership. All over the world, particularly in the newer nations, young men are coming to power. Men who are not bound by the traditions of the past. Men who are not blinded by the old fears and hate and rivalries. Young men who can cast off the old slogans and the old delusions. The Republican nominee, of course, is a young man. But his approach is as old as McKinley. His party is the party of the past, the party of memory. His speeches are generalities from Poor Richard's Almanac. Their platform made up of old leftover Democratic planks, has the courage of our old convictions. Their pledge is to the status quo, and today there is no status quo.
How about that phrase, the courage of our old convictions? JFK from the 1960 Democratic Convention. And with that, we welcome Douglas Brinkley and Stephen Kennedy Smith, editors now of JFK in Words and Pictures. Douglas, welcome back. Stephen, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And since we have to begin somewhere, let's begin with Kennedy's election in 1960 over Richard Nixon. Even though today we think of Kennedy as a giant and Nixon as somewhere between a flea and a rat on a flea, or a flea on a rat, JFK won it by a whisker. Douglas, what was the divide between Kennedy voters and Nixon voters in America at that time that made it so close?
Well, first off, that was so wonderful hearing John F. Kennedy talk at Los Angeles. And that's when he launched the phrase, the new frontier, in earnest. And then everybody said, are you part of the new frontier? That was his rollout of, like FDR had the New Deal and Harry Truman had the Fair Deal. He came out of Los Angeles with a lot of steam at that convention. But it became really the debates in that fall that made the big difference. John F. Kennedy was the first television candidate for president, and he was remarkable in the debates. Cool, calm, he didn't seem like a novice. And Nixon, if you watched on television, kind of had that dark shadow and the beady sweat and all of that. And so he did – that really helped Kennedy, the debates. He also put being the first Catholic behind him. But when election night came, it was neck to neck. John F. Kennedy was up at Hyannisport. Wow, look what's happening. We got to wait for these returns from the Midwest. In the end, it was Illinois and Texas. The fact that Kennedy was able to win those, I think, put him over the top. But he became president recognizing.
He won Texas, huh?
Yes.
A Democrat.
And he had Lyndon Johnson on as VP. Yep. That helped. But the last point I'd make is that he came into that famous inaugural recognizing he wanted to unite the country, heal the country, because it was a close election. It wasn't a mandate.
Stephen, that excerpt from that convention speech, invoking hope and speaking skeptically of tradition. How classic JFK was that?
Yeah, so in that same speech, he said that the world is changing and the old ways will not do. And he called for a new era of invention, imagination, and decision. And so what's remarkable about President Kennedy's speeches is that they're so relevant to today. And so we really wanted to make this book a conversation with some of the leading global figures of today about the relevance of John F. Kennedy's ideas. Doug spoke about the 1960 election. One of the reasons that was so close is because when you look at the returns, JFK was the first Catholic elected, and he was the election was heavily influenced by anti-Catholicism, even though he was a young and attractive candidate. So in many ways, they were dealing with the same issues of bigotry, of mistrust, of division in the country at that time as we face today.
Since you both brought that up already, let me play this additional clip from the convention speech, and I'm actually going to contrast it with something that happened in the 2016 presidential election. Kennedy was, of course, the first Catholic president, and here is how he dealt in his acceptance speech with that as a matter of controversy.
I hope that no American, considering the really critical issues facing this country, will waste his franchise and throw away his vote by voting either for me or against me because of my religious affiliation. It is not relevant. I am telling you what you are entitled to know. As I come before you, seeking your support for the most powerful office in the free world, I am saying to you that my decisions on every public policy will be my own, as an American, as a Democrat, and as a free man.
JFK in 1960. By contrast, Ben Carson campaigned at one point when he was in the primaries, saying he wouldn't trust a Muslim as president. Mike Flynn, now discredited, but he was elevated to National Security Advisor at the beginning of the Trump administration, tweeted, "It's rational to fear Muslims." And here's Mike Pence last year accepting his position as Trump's running mate at his introductory news conference.
I'm a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order.
In that order. Douglas, how do you see the changing place of religion in politics as exemplified by that contrast? JFK said the exact opposite of what Mike Pence just said. Pence saying he's a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order. Can you imagine if JFK had said that in his acceptance speech in 1960?
Well, John F. Kennedy was too fine a man to say something like that. You don't want to put a religion and make that the litmus test in politics. Unfortunately, in recent years, we're seeing that happen more and more. Barack Obama was constantly accused of being a Muslim by many people of the Republican Party. Donald Trump, our current president, said he's not even born in the country, mocking his religion, even though Barack Obama was a Christian, but trying to confuse people on it. Kennedy got it right. He put behind the Catholic issue earlier than the convention. He spoke to in Houston, Texas, to a group of ministers and was able to convince people, look, I'm an American. I'm not a Catholic first. That's, of course, always the way you should run for president. 2016 was in recent times, it's been a deviation of that. Thomas Jefferson would roll over in his grave if he heard Pence say that.
So we asked in the book His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Rick Warren, and Tariq Ramadan to all comment on Kennedy's speech to the Houston Ministerial Association. And their comments were masterful about really the separation.
Which is to say a Buddhist, a Muslim, and a Christian.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. And I think they all agreed that, you know, his speech was masterful and that he had handled the issue the right way.
And, Stephen, you quote de Tocqueville on the difference between patriotism in Europe and patriotism here. in the book, and then you muse on how JFK nonetheless understood the rituals inherent in American patriotism. And you wrote that Kennedy's book, his own book, Profiles in Courage, reflected a complex patriotism. What's a complex patriotism?
Yeah, so President Kennedy was the last American president to fight in combat, and he did believe in a strong defense, but his patriotism was not the patriotism of nationalism and military spending. It was the patriotism of individual acts of conscience and belief and of, you know, our shared civic ideals, you know, freedom of the press, freedom from religious discrimination, civil rights, social and economic opportunity, and, you know, truly representative democracy that was not dominated by special interests. He stood up against the steel companies when they tried to exorbitantly raise prices. And he, you know, was a classic Democrat in his defense of working people.
You want to add something,
Douglas?
Well,
I was just going to say, and I mean, just look at JFK's first 100 days, which had its difficult moments, but you can tell his character. He created the Peace Corps right out of the bat to project American values and caring around the world. And he went on, instead of talking about building a wall with Mexico, he wanted to open up the friendship. He created the Alliance for Progress in his first 100 days to make the greatest moment of friendship between in our hemisphere. So there's that side of him. He's constantly talking about peace, but doing real things to try to move the peace agenda forward.
At Kennedy's first 100 days, he finished with an 80% approval rating, which of course is twice the current president as he just completed his first 100 days. But those things you mentioned, Douglas, do you think that they would be met with skepticism by the American public today, that kind of idealism? You know, because Trump was elected on exactly the opposite notion of America first, of withdrawal from the world to some degree. So the Peace Corps, the Alliance for Progress, things like that, did they fail on some degree, on some level, either around the world or just what they were supposed to do for the United States, that we've come to this point?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Hillary Clinton won by 3 million votes, and she didn't run a particularly great campaign in the end. Hindsight's easy. But look at Joe Biden. He's going all around talking about a moonshot. Where did he get the moonshot idea from John F. Kennedy, pulling the country together for space exploration and science? And that happened May 25th, 1961, shortly into his administration. In her book, Walter Isaacson writes about the moonshot. Biden's moonshot is the war on cancer. So he's trying to find something. We all want to be, unite against fighting cancer. So that's what the spirit of Kennedy was. How can we work together in the best sense of Americanism? And today we're living in an era of just very corrosive and divisive politics.
Bonnie in Brooklyn Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I wanted to ask the historians, is there any evidence that the election was stolen for Kennedy? Sometimes I've heard, you know, read things up to that nature, especially around Chicago.
Oh, well, that's a big bit of controversy. There are two different sides to that story. What we do know is, there's some people that fear that Mayor Daley of Chicago was able to bring out the so-called cemetery vote. It hasn't been proven like that. But it always is going to be that way when an election is that close and we live in this electoral college system. So I'd say the verdict's kind of open on what actually occurred in Illinois. But, it was Richard. We just have to let Nixon himself decided not to challenge it. And incidentally, Nixon wasn't a bad candidate in 1960. You know, he was a two-term vice president. He wasn't an elect. They really had some big, great debates. And Nixon obviously goes on to win the presidency two times on his own. So yeah. It wasn't that Kennedy beat some piker that didn't have some political wallop in him.
By the way, a few people called in to say the last president to have fought in combat was not Kennedy, but George H.W. Bush.
I stand corrected.
So just for the record. Marie in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marie.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to react briefly to the discussion of JFK downplaying his Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And while I agree that that was probably a very principled stance and probably a reflection to some degree of founding fathers' values and views of religion and so on, I also wonder if it wasn't at least somewhat strategic in the sense that at the time, certainly more so than now, being Catholic was potentially a suspect sort of cultural position to be in. Catholicism was a little bit more othered, I think, at that time than it is now. And he may have been strategically reassuring the Protestant majority that he was going to sort of
right, as opposed to standing on the high ideal of separation of church and state for its own sake.
Yeah, good point. And it's true. I mean, and also keep in mind, John F. Kennedy was deeply proud of his Catholicism. He just didn't want to make that the litmus test of whether he should or shouldn't be president. Being the first to pioneer in something, is significant. Al Smith was the nominee for the Democrats for president, and Al Smith got hammered on being Catholic. So this wave of anti-Catholicism was really very real in 1960, but Kennedy wanted to reassure Protestant America that he wasn't going to be serving the Pope, he was serving the American people.
Okay, some comparisons that are maybe too easy, but Kennedy, like Trump, had the advantage of a personal fortune when running for president. Like Trump, Kennedy had a private plane. Kennedy named his after his daughter. It was called the Caroline. That's in the book. Trump's was called Trump Force One. The book notes that Kennedy was a voracious reader. Trump's co-author on The Art of the Deal, Tony Schwartz, said last year he never saw a book on Trump's desk or elsewhere in his office or his apartment. I seriously doubt that Trump has ever read a book straight through in his adult life, unquote. This year, Trump told The Times he doesn't need to read much because he makes good decisions, quote, with very little knowledge other than the knowledge I had, plus the words common sense because I have a lot of common sense. Karl Rove says George W. Bush and he had an annual competition for who could read the most books. Stephen, you wrote an essay in this book about JFK as a reader. What did he like to read?
He read voraciously everything. He read a lot of Greek history, Roman history, European history. When we actually found a trove of speeches from British prime ministers in the attic in Hyannisport at one point that President Kennedy had collected. He was a great student of history. He was a talented historian himself. He wrote a very good review of the Adams Papers. And so I think from an early age, he was sort of fascinated by politics. Of course, he traveled before the war and saw Hitler and Churchill speak. He understood that oratory could bring out the best or worst in people. With regard to what you just said, puts me in mind of the speech that he gave called The Politician and the Intellectual, where he said that our nation's founders were also our nation's first great intellectuals. Books were their tools, not their enemies. So he definitely was part of that Western Enlightenment tradition.
Douglas, 30 seconds left. Is there a tendency to romanticize JFK? Do you think we do that? And if so, how?
I think there was a moment after his death when there was kind of a Camelot, with Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and Ted Sorensen and his advisors. But not since then. The scholarship's gotten so deep and wide that there are so many books on John F. Kennedy. I think on the 100th birthday, though, people are really appreciating the contrast between a speaker and a man of intellect and a healer like John F. Kennedy tried to be, and a world leader, and some of the problems we're seeing with Donald Trump's kind of divisive politics. David McCullough, incidentally, in the book, writes a brilliant, I think, essay looking at Kennedy as an intellectual writer. And he wanted to be a journalist, John F. Kennedy. He actually wrote for Hearst Papers, stories for the United Nations, and covered Potsdam and all that before he entered politics.
Enemy of the people. That proves it. This big, beautiful book is called JFK in Words and Pictures, Douglas Brinkley and Stephen Kennedy Smith. Thank you both so much for starting out here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, live from the Green Space. Good morning again, everyone. Joining me now is renowned historian David McCullough. He's won two Pulitzer Prizes for his biographies of Presidents John Adams and Harry Truman, also the National Book Award. He hosted The American Experience on PBS for 12 years, narrated Ken Burns' Civil War documentary, and has even been given our nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. David McCullough is also known for his speeches that often contextualize contemporary issues with pertinent moments from American history. That may all be moot now, as we may have jumped the shark of American history as we know it. We'll find out what David McCullough thinks. But he's curated and edited 15 of his speeches for his latest book, The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For, in hopes that they will, quote, remind us of those things at this particular moment. Please welcome David McCullough to WNYC and the Green Space. And listeners, we can take some phone calls for David McCullough at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Just for a little political context around the current moment, you've kept your political views private for most of your career, but you came out strongly against Trump, I see, during the election campaign. You're 83 years old. Why now?
Because I felt that we were going down a very dangerous track, and that we had to put the brakes on and stop and consider who we are, what we stand for, and are we going to dispense with all of that in order to put someone in the pilot seat who's never, ever flown a plane before and who doesn't understand how our government works, who has no interest in the history of the country and has said so on more than one occasion, has never read a book about the presidency or a biography of a president, and claims, as he said in an interview in the Washington Post, that he doesn't need to read books because he knows so much intuitively. And I remember Jefferson said, any nation that expects to be ignorant and free expects what never was and never will be. We are a country based on the love of learning, on the improvement of our way of life through learning. We are people who believe in the truth. We are people who believe in tolerance, who believe in hard work, and having aspirations beyond material acquisition. And we want to bring our children up that way. I've dedicated this book to my 19 grandchildren because I hope that what I have to say will extend beyond my own children's generation to the new one coming on. And I really know from a lifetime in the field that I've made my specialty that one of the best of all ways to learn about almost anything is to read history. And that history isn't just about politics and the military. It's about life. It's about art and music and dance and science and finance. It's about human beings. It's not boring statistics. It's not memorizing dates, heaven knows, or quotations. It's about human beings and how we can attain aspirations that we may think impossible if we work together.
I see at a speech that you gave at Dartmouth in 1995 that's included in the book, while stressing the importance of reading history, you said, I don't think we can ever know enough about our presidents, particularly before putting them in the job. The truth is, of course, it makes an enormous difference who is in the White House.
A tremendous difference. And we can't expect an exceptional president every time. Exceptional presidents, as I try to tell students, exceptional presidents are the exception. But they do happen, and they often happen in a surprising way. Harry Truman, I think, probably being as strong an illustration of that as anyone. And they're very different from one another. I have known through interviews or time spent with seven of our presidents, and they are all interesting figures and all quite different from each other. The two I know best are Harry Truman and John Adams. And I was asked once at the end of a talk I gave at a university in California, the questioner said, aside from Harry Truman and John Adams, how many others have you interviewed? I had to explain that appearances notwithstanding, I did not know John Adams or Harry Truman.
And I heard, who was it, W.E.B. Du Bois, making a comeback these days?
Yeah, right. That wonderful line of Gerald Ford's, if Abraham Lincoln were alive today, he'd be turning over in his grave. Gerald Ford, by the way, is a much misunderstood president. He was much more important and admirable president than he's generally perceived as, and an interesting presence. He didn't last very long, but an awful lot happened. And there's a good man working on a good biography of Ford now, I understand, which I'm very pleased about. I spent much of one whole day with him, and I was so struck by how different he was from the way he had been portrayed. You know, the fellow that wore his football helmet, well, played without his helmet, and would fall down when he got off an airplane. A president can make one little mistake like that, and just they don't let up on it. Lyndon Johnson loved to tear Ford apart unfairly.
He was president for such a short amount of time.
Yes.
After the impeachment, or the resignation, prior to impeachment of Richard
Nixon.
And
nobody ever had to be interviewed for the job, and be passed on by... Well, anyway.
Were you just impressed with him as a person when you spent time with him? Or
yes.
Is there something about his legacy
in the White House? He had finished the White House, and I was invited to the Ford Library in Michigan to come and give a talk. And he not only showed me around the museum, but talked at length and quite candidly about various people and about various problems. And I was struck by his... He seemed to have both feet on the ground about the work. He was a very professional, full-time public servant his whole working life. And it's a profession. It's a trade. You have to know it. You can't just jump right in and think, oh, I'll know how to do this. It doesn't work that way. And the qualities that I think are essential above all are strength of character.
Uh-oh.
Well, on the mantelpiece in the White House, there is a line carved into the marble that's taken from a letter written by the first president ever to occupy the White House. That was John Adams. He was there overnight for the first time of any human being that's ever been president. And his wife was delayed in coming with him, and he wrote her a letter in which he said, among other things, may none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof. And that was carved, first of all, Franklin Roosevelt had it carved into the wood of the fireplace, and then President Truman, when they rebuilt the White House, had it replaced. And then John Kennedy, when he was president, had a change made, had it carved into the marble so it was certain to last. And what I think is so powerful about that is he said, may none but honest and wise men. He puts honest first.
And he put men in particular.
Yes. Well, that's all we knew yet. And still, but honest and wise men. And those are the fundamental values of tolerance and optimism and the capacity to use the English language. Imagine that. Imagine. And to think before you speak.
Is the amount... People would push back, you know, there are Trump supporters who push back on that he's really actually brilliant at using the English language. Was it Bannon? I realize it was quoting Steve Bannon on Donald Trump, but I think it was Bannon who said he's the greatest orator since William Jennings Bryan.
Oh.
He gets these crowds.
What do you want? You want me to...
Well, I mean, you know,
that's ridiculous. Abraham Lincoln, John Kennedy. I was asked to give the memorial talk at Kennedy's memorial service in Dallas just a few years ago, 50th anniversary. And I went back and reread Kennedy's speeches. And, oh, my goodness, breathtaking, thrilling. And one of the things very interesting about Kennedy is he almost never talked, think of this, never talked about himself. Mm. The first person singular mm-hmm. very seldom enters in. And the idea that he said, we will go to the moon, that's American. That's we can undertake hitherto seemingly impossible accomplishments and succeed if we work together.
We're being, you know, pretty direct here about Trump, but I'm going to continue it. Is the amount of lying at the level of just making stuff up outside the norms of American political history,
yes.
or is it naive to think
yes,
that?
Yes, it is.
It is.
But let me make a point that I think needs to be expressed by lots of us. The job that the media is doing today, print, to be sure, but radio and television too.
Internet.
Excels any performance of their responsibility that I know of in our past. It's superb. They are rising to fill the very role that the Constitution declares to be their responsibility. And it's some of the best reporting, the fairest, most accurate reporting that I can remember. And when they publish the things that are being said on a weekly basis as kind of a calendar of this last week's of what aren't true, that's marvelous. And because who are we to know if somebody doesn't remind us what he just said isn't true? And what is so disturbing is he doesn't seem to care. Now, do we want to raise our children and grandchildren on that kind of ethical standard? And
what does it say to you about the American people, in whom I think you have great faith?
I do.
That so much of this was known during the campaign at the level of character, and enough people to elect him voted for him anyway.
That enough people were sufficiently distressed about their place in life and how the fortunes of life seem to be so often against them, that they were willing to grasp out at almost any snake oil salesman who happened along. That's my interpretation.
In your speech to Ohio University in 2004, in the book titled The Bulwark of Freedom, you said, when bad news is riding high and despair is in fashion, when loud mouths and corruption seem to own center stage, when some keep crying that the country is going to the dogs, remember, it's always been going to the dogs in the eyes of some. Is that a good quote for today?
I hope so. I meant it then, and I mean it now. I think that we are a good country. 90% of us are great people, good people, wanting to do the right thing, work hard every day, try to be at work on time, raising our children as best we can, educating them as best we can. And we shouldn't lose heart because there's always so much bad news in the forefront. Bad news moves newspapers and brings people to television. I'm concerned that we are becoming a nation of spectators, and I'm very concerned about the influence of big money on politics. I think we all ought to be very concerned about that and stop it as soon as it's possible to stop it.
Let's go to a question for David McCullough here in the green space. Hi.
Hi. I'm interested in hearing about how you've seen the role of history in political discourse change over the course of your career as a historian. And I say that because Donald Trump is in some ways aggressively ahistorical, but his campaign has also kind of drawn on a mythological history of America in an interesting way.
And your question is?
So my question is, how has the role of history in political discourse changed?
Politicians traditionally have all been using history, knowing history, and using it effectively from when we first began as a country. We have never had a great president who wasn't a scholar, a reader, a believer in history. You can just see them all the way along. Woodrow Wilson was a professor of history. Theodore Roosevelt wrote an excellent history of the Naval War of 1812 when he was still in college. Dwight Eisenhower's Crusade in Europe is, I think, one of the very best books ever written about the history of the Second World War, and he wrote it all himself. Harry Truman, who never went to college, never stopped reading history. He said the only new thing in the world is the history you don't know. And he understood that what presidents don't do is often as important as what they do do. So when he decided that he would not use the atomic bomb in Korea, that was a momentous decision. When Eisenhower decided, I will not go into Vietnam, another immensely momentous decision. And the history is about cause and effect, and history sets examples of leadership. You can't. The best leaders are all readers. It's been true all along. And you can't ignore the life of the mind, and you can't ignore the lessons that history teaches us in all of aspects of life.
Politicians often misuse history, I would imagine, in making points that are either inaccurate or don't create accurate analogies to things that are going on today?
Yes. Well, anybody can find something in the Bible that makes their point. And history is much like that, because history is many-sided. History is human. That's the essential thing to remember.
On the other hand, I remember when Michelle Obama said, I'm living in a house that was built by slaves, and that may not have been something that has been on Americans' minds, and she brought it back to the fore.
Well, it should be brought back to the fore. The first president to occupy the White House, John Adams, never owned a slave. Never owned a slave as a matter of principle, because he didn't believe it. He thought that he was wrong. His wife felt even more strongly on the attitude. The next president who didn't believe in slavery was their son, John Quincy Adams. We had seven presidents who were all slaveholders. But at the same time, keep this in mind, our country doubled in size with what was called the Northwest Ordinance, which brought in what are now the states of Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Illinois, and the Congress of the United States, before we had a constitution, the summer of 1787, passed the Northwest Ordinance, in which it was ordained forever that there, in that territory, there would be no slavery. That was equal to half of all the country in territory. Now, granted, there was no one living there except Native Americans at the time. But nonetheless, it was a huge step in the right direction, which we don't pay any attention to or give any credit for the very people who let the Constitution go through without having slavery.
We have a question right here, I think. Hi.
Hi. Professor McCullough, if I understood you right when you talked about why Trump was able to be elected by enough people in this country to become president, do you think there's some way in which Obama's presidency set us up for Trump at this time?
Well, there's unquestionably an element in our country still that feels not at ease with an African-American president, as there are many people who were against Mrs. Clinton because she was a woman. But at the same time, we elected Barack Obama, and at the same time, let us not forget that Mrs. Clinton won the election with a popular vote of nearly 3 million people. So it isn't the loser is the total loser. She wasn't a total loser. She was, in fact, the winner. And that ought to give us inspiration. That ought to give us hope that we can approach male, female, black, white in a fair and open-minded way.
Also on the dissatisfaction in the land today, as a historian, maybe we have lived through an ahistorical bubble of good times in this country after World War II that is just not sustainable unless the whole rest of the world is on its knees and unless technology ceases to progress. And so we have today's sense of decline from the standpoint of the wealthiest country in the history of the world. And maybe it's an ahistorical bubble, and we need that context to even begin this conversation.
No, I don't agree. I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because, yes, you can say we're on decline, but in many ways we are not on decline. We are on the upward path. Look what has been accomplished in our lifetimes in medicine. My God, unbelievable. That happened here. It didn't happen anywhere else. Look what we've created in our higher educational system in this country. Now, yes, well, there are problems with it. Yes, it's become too expensive. But we've created the greatest universities and colleges in the world in our lifetime. And that's no minor achievement. We've also given more opportunity to more of our people of all kinds and races, colors, everything. And let's never forget that we are all immigrants.
Obama made a big point of saying we're living at the best time to be alive in the history of the world. It sounds like you agree.
I do agree. That's not to say we don't have problems, but we have always had problems. Problems are what we call life. And if we're going to think, oh, we got a terrible problem, then we're spoiled brats who haven't any realization of what happened before us. We have to know what our predecessors have been through, what they sacrificed, what they did in the cause of improvement, of progress, of both emotional and intellectual and physical and material progress. What they went through in the Civil War, what they went through in the influenza epidemic of 1918-1919. Most people don't know anything about that. 500,000 Americans died in less than 1 year of influenza. If that were to happen today, given our population, it would be 1.5 million people would die from a disease that we don't know where it came from, we don't know how it is going to go away, and so forth. Imagine that on the nightly news today. What a state of agitation and frenzy and madness we'd be in. But they got through it, just as they got through the Depression and those horrendous world wars.
Anthony in Greenberg, New York, you're on WNYC with David McCullough. Anthony, you there?
Yeah, I'm a great fan of him. I have a history degree from Mercy College. And I wanted to say, he just said something really, really poignant to me about how white people have become dissatisfied in this country and feel like they've been left out. You know, well, I'm black, and we've been left out for 200 years. You know, and nobody ever recognizes that. They say all of a sudden white people are so disaffected, so disenfranchised. Well, black unemployment is still down. You know, black pay rate is lower than white people's pay rates. You know, I mean, I don't understand. What do they think President Obama gave black people? Because he became president, we didn't raise up any. Mass incarceration is still there for our people. Most of us go to jail for big crimes that white people don't go to jail for. You know, and I don't understand why they're so dissatisfied. We've been dissatisfied. It's not like we won anything when Obama became president.
What's the legacy of Obama for you, Anthony? Is it nothing in particular?
A president. No, that we elected a black man as president.
I hear you.
And that
a brilliant man too, a brilliant black man, and he was a good president, you know. But on the other hand, I still think when people talk about deportation, nobody cries. Obama deported more people than Trump has deported right now. You know, but nobody had his shortcomings.
Yes, I think Harry Truman said you have to wait 50 years for the dust to settle in order to judge a president. And it's very hard to say how history will treat Barack Obama. My guess is that history will treat him very well. He brought to the White House a sense of balance, not just about the racial makeup of our country and the injustices that black people have endured, but he brought an intellectual level to the White House that was superb. And I didn't agree with everything he did, but I thought he brought also a marvelous First Lady. And he was and remains a gentleman. He showed us how to behave like a grown-up gentleman of responsibility in the most important leadership role in the world and in all history. Nobody can do the job perfectly. Nobody can be in there more than a couple of months and not make mistakes. But that's the nature of it. And we have to be very careful what kind of people we choose and what kind of people we encourage to pursue a life in public service. We must not let politics become a responsibility, a role as citizens, which nobody wants to have anything to do with anymore. We need to summon the best that's in us to take these roles.
I want to thank David McCullough. And David McCullough's new book, a collection of his speeches, is called The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. Thank you so much. It's been a great honor. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, my conversation with On the Media's Brooke Gladstone about her great new book, The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time, plus John Waters and his advice for new graduates. But first, the news, live from the WNYC newsroom. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. It's the Brian Lehrer show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. If you believe reality itself is engaged in an epic existential battle right now, if you're trying not to feel helpless as the truth is trampled into dust, has Brooke Gladstone got a book for you? It's an 87-page essay called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. In this little book that you can practically read on one long subway ride, Brooke draws on the wisdom of so many people: Hannah Arendt, Walter Lippmann, George Orwell, Philip K. Dick, Ursula K. Le Guin, and Jonathan Swift, to name a few, to help us understand what the heck is going on with this twisted moment in our history. I won't bore you by trying to describe it more than that. Let's just hear from Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor of On the Media, and now the author of The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. Hi, Brooke, and congratulations. This is awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, the book is so small. I should have said a rumination on existential panic in our time, because people don't really understand what moral panic means. It sounds like it's panic over morality, but actually it is about the nature of life itself. It's a kind of false cognate. And people think that I'm drawing moral lessons in the title, which I'm not. I do it later on a little bit, but not there.
Well, there are so many places we could start, but let's enter here. You compare the two classic books, 1984 by George Orwell and Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, through the lens of the late NYU Media Studies professor Neil Postman. Mm-hmm. Both those books describe totalitarian worlds we could find ourselves in, but one of them struck Postman as more relevant to today, and I think struck you that way too. Will you take us there?
Sure, absolutely. Postman was writing about this in his 1985 classic book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, which still has a great deal to teach us, even though it does precede the internet and the impact of digital technology. And I think some of the things that he projects are off. But in terms of the Orwell-Huxley comparison, here's what he wrote. He wrote, "What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much information that we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared that we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared that we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with the equivalent of the feelies, the orgy porgy, and the centrifugal bumble puppy." In 1984, Orwell added, "People are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure." In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us.
It was that last one that really stopped me short in my tracks when I was reading the book. In 1984, Orwell added, "People are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they're controlled by inflicting pleasure." And it's that that you say was the world that led us ineluctably to the election of Donald Trump.
Absolutely. How could it be otherwise? I mean, Trump's campaign was an endless stream of comedy and melodrama, apocalypse and deliverance. It was incredibly entertaining, no matter what your politics were. To some, it was enthrallingly frank, I wrote. But to others, ultimately, Trump's victory shattered reality. And it was much more than about a political outcome you didn't like or a president you didn't respect or even feared. If you live long enough, you're bound to have those experiences many times over your life. And you can feel a kind of dread. But what I was hearing in our Eastern elite bubble, in our cohort, and basically from cities all around the country, because it seems to be a city-country thing even more than a policy or a party thing, was that this sense of dread was more extreme, more chilling, more disabling, because it got to the core of our beliefs of how the world worked. And so I decided to, you know, take a deep dive into trying to figure out exactly how do we construct the worlds we live in? Why do we construct those worlds? Is it even possible to see past the boundaries of our own infinite bubbles? And I honestly think it isn't like there are two in this country. I think there are as many bubbles as there are individuals. They are bespoke. They are handcrafted. And we craft them for a reason. And we've been doing it for as long as we've existed.
And this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We're in New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Another reference from the book. You quote the English poet John Milton, most famous for Paradise Lost, in a polemic against censorship to the British government in the 1700s. That inspired Thomas Jefferson. Mm-hmm. But I think you now find it naive.
Right. Yeah. Well, here's the thing, is that what Milton said and what Jefferson later echoed was that if you place truth in a battle with falsehood, truth will always win. Milton believed that the people fundamentally grew wise with exposure to information. And Jefferson certainly believed this. Now, not all the founding fathers did. Madison didn't really believe it. Hamilton certainly didn't. And the fact is that we know now that information does not lead to a higher truth. We create our worlds from the seen and the unseen. The seen are the facts, but until they are marinated in our traditions and our values, until we place them into a narrative context that we agree with, all of those things, and we leave out the ones that don't fit, information alone won't do it. Fact-checking alone won't stop Trump. The only way to stop Trump, if you want to stop Trump, is to make sure that those facts can fit into the lives of people who don't agree with you. In other words, you have to place them in a context, you have to explain their relevance, and then you have to wait. Yes, you have to wait for the world to bear you out.
But if the argument in the 1700s that inspired Jefferson and others was that censorship is bad because more information leads to good political decision making. Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly have more information in today's world than we've ever had before, mm-hmm. and there is no shortage of bad political decision making. But are you suggesting that some of the very best values of our nation, because the First Amendment was based on this idea, are based on utopian wishful thinking and are bound to fail us?
Well, what are values? Values are our better angels. They don't necessarily reflect what's in the real world. But we have to understand that these are not mechanical principles. This is not physics. This is philosophy. We want to believe that information will make us better people, a more informed electorate, as Jefferson would say. But many people, including John Adams, and I quote him towards the end of the book, he says, remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. The passions are the same in all men under all forms of simple government, and when unchecked, produce the same effects of fraud, violence, and cruelty. Individuals have conquered themselves, nations and large bodies of men never. In other words, we believe it is a liberal principle. It is one of our foundational beliefs that democracy is the best system and democracy works. And what did we see in this election? A sense that it didn't work, that something went wrong. And I examine the role of the press. I examine the masterful use of alternate forms of information and actually casting doubt on the very possibility of knowing reality. I mean, when Trump says that all of the organs of accountability, whether it's the Congressional Budget Office or the media, are simply other special interest groups with their own agenda, and that you don't believe them, you shouldn't believe them, you don't have to believe them, you can pick who you want to believe based on absolutely nothing more than your inclination, because the truth cannot be known. The truth, if you support me, is what I say it is today, and whatever I say it is tomorrow, support me too, because I've made you some promises, and that's our deal, right? And so that's what we're confronted with. This is different from the Bush administration, which many people threw their hands up at, because they were offering an alternate reality, but it was a consistent one and a stable one. It was Karl Rove who told the New York Times reporter Ron Suskind that you and the reality-based community have to understand that we're going to be throwing realities at you as we choose, and you're just going to have to deal with that. But the departure for Trump is that he is throwing at us the idea that there is no reality, or that it's optional, just build your own.
The most interesting part of your book for me, I think, was the Hannah Arendt section.
Mm.
Hannah Arendt, the Hitler and Stalin era political theorist, who said would-be totalitarian rulers usually start their careers by boasting of their past crimes and carefully outlining their future ones. That is so Trumpian, it's creepy. And she wrote that in 1951?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she did, in a book chillingly titled The Origins of Totalitarianism. Now, I want to say that I am not comparing Trump to Hitler or his followers to Nazis. I am talking purely about Arendt's description of how the Nazis, and particularly Hitler, used the engines of media, used rhetoric, and spoke to a disaffected population that had been ignored for generations, or at least a really bad generation of being ignored, in order to create an immense constituency. And the kinds of rhetoric that was used were very, bear such strong parallels to what we saw in the past election. Again, I'm not saying to the same end. I'm simply saying the techniques are really illustrative and they're worth taking a look at. And she took a very close look and missed nothing.
So you're right that once again, the so-called carnival barker seized a mallet and smashed an essential stereotype that our democracy was based on a set of shared values. You mean we couldn't even agree as a nation that these things most New Yorkers found hateful or even bad?
The thing is that there was a bargain. There was, yeah, you know, I think that if you said, do we believe that everyone is equal, probably everyone in the country would believe that. But what they see with their eyes is a sense of being ignored while all the media attention is on, you know, immigrants and people in the inner city being shot. And, hey, what about us? We're here. We don't have jobs. We're dying at higher rates from opioid addiction and gun violence and so on. It's a sense that there's complete chaos, and there's also a sense, I believe, of entitlement, that they deserve this attention before it goes to anybody else, especially any recent immigrants to the United States. And here's the thing. I'm not saying listen to these people, understand them, see if you can find some common ground. No, I'm not saying that. You have values. I have values. I will cling to them. I have to have them and hold fast to them. But all I know is that many of our fundamental beliefs about how things work got smashed. And if you want to ease that sense of unsettlement, then you have to figure out how to paste your world back together, create a more durable reality. And the only way you can do that is if you figure out what actually happened and why, and that necessitates going out and listening to what people say.
Another Hannah Arendt quote you include is, "The spokesmen for totalitarian movements possessed an unerring instinct for anything that ordinary party propaganda or public opinion did not care to touch. The mob really believed the truth was whatever respectable society had hypocritically passed over or covered with corruption. And the modern masses do not believe in anything visible. What convinces masses are not facts, and not even invented facts, but only the consistency of the system of which they are presumably part." So creepily eerie to what we're seeing now, or as you deeply analyze it in the book, yikes.
Well, the thing is, you know, I was uncomfortable with her using the term masses, although it was much more commonly used both for the right and the left. I mean, one great left-wing magazine was called the Modern Masses, yeah. I believe, or the Masses. But in this case, she's talking about the followers of Hitler. But I think that we all long for consistency in our positions, and we are all loath to change. And there is a whole lot of interesting data that suggests that, because our realities are built on a web of beliefs. Fundamentally, they have found there was a study of visitors to a site about climate change, and it was a well-conducted study, and they found that people who had a strong belief in the free market did not have a strong belief in climate change. Well, you can imagine why. There's a relationship there. They also didn't have a strong belief in HIV causing AIDS. They also didn't have a strong belief in smoking causing cancer. All of these things can be traced back to this strong foundational belief in the free market. You can't have that and science happening at the same time if one is going to call the other one into challenge. That is that web of beliefs I'm talking about. And don't think this just happens on the right.
So you describe a classic authoritarian deal that Trump made to his followers. And I think you were just alluding to this. And again, not to suggest in you quoting Hannah Arendt that Trump wants to be Hitler or wants to be Stalin, but it's still a classic authoritarian deal in type with his supporters. You write, you can bask in my favor and recognition in the promises I make and the license I bestow. And all I ask in return is that you believe whatever I say whenever I say it, even when it is false, even when it contradicts the reality of your own experience. Arendt saw that in her time, too.
Right, absolutely. And why? Because if you catch me in a lie tomorrow, it doesn't matter. You'll just wink. You're in on the joke. Because the facts really don't matter. Because, as I said, the truth is a liar.
Do you think anyone ever said, I take Hitler seriously but not literally?
Well, we certainly know that the coverage of Hitler was very derisive and no one took him seriously until it was too late.
Brooke Gladstone, our On the Media host and managing editor, is now the author of The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time, and we'll continue with Brooke in just a minute. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor of On the Media, here with her new book called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. So there is just one quote that I noticed you used twice in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me why this is that important. It's from Walter Lippmann, the newspaper man from 100 years ago. And he says in the 1920s, if the newspapers are to be charged with the duty of translating the whole public life of mankind so that every adult can arrive at an opinion on every moot topic, they fail. They are bound to fail in any future one can conceive. They will continue to fail. Fail at what?
To really grab hold of the people and to inform them. The reason why it appears in two places, Brian, is because in the early part of the book, I talk about one of our foundational beliefs that was shattered, which is that information will lead to wisdom. Because it's foundational because our founding fathers did believe it, and they created laws in order to that were based entirely on that are uniquely American. The First Amendment, obviously, exists because the founding fathers were convinced that wisdom emerged from information. They codified civil liberties to ensure that our speech and press were free. But the thing is that even though it saw the press as a vital institution, it didn't support it like a vital institution. It was still a business. And as Lippmann complained in the 20s, people don't like to pay for information. Even then, they like to pay for entertainment. And it was entertainment that kept the presses rolling, and it was entertainment that became the tail that was wagging the dog of actual useful information. And then I used it again because we jump ahead to now, and we see a time, a great moment that I think many in the media have been waiting for since Craigslist began and since newspapers started posting their information online for free, which is that if you want high-quality information, if you want information that you can trust from people that you trust, even if they do make mistakes sometimes, then you have to pay for it. This is an idea that went entirely out of fashion. We've always been able to pay for entertainment. When I was a kid, TV was free. Now we all pay for TV. We pay to be entertained, mostly. And, it's ESPN that makes the most money. So in this case, people...
And even they just had a lot of people off.
Well, there you go.
Because everything's going to the web.
We have increasingly moved towards free information where we can get it, no matter what the quality is. We'll just grab it and consume it like entertainment, something else Neil Postman worried about back in the 80s. But now we realize we have to pay for it. And as a result, ailing great news organizations are staffing up. The Times, The Post, public radio is stronger, I think, than it's ever been. Certainly WNYC has been the beneficiary of listeners realizing that they need this stuff. They want this stuff. And I repeated it again because right now the media have taken on Trump with the strength of the people who are supporting them, their audience. And should the audience fall away, then that engine of accountability will run out of gas again, and it will just sputter into disuse, and there won't be any engines of accountability. Right now, the trust in the media is so low in Republican echo chambers. I think it's down to 14%. I think it's 51% among Democrats.
So the second time you use the Lippman quote, it's in the context of the Washington media growing a spine in the era of Trump, as you were just laying out. Information, investigation, clarity, less giving equal weight to false equivalencies for the sake of looking balanced.
Mm-hmm.
But you wonder whether Lippman would laugh or cheer or cry. Why?
Well, he was cynical about the prospects of the media carrying the whole load. He said the problem isn't just that the media is a business. The problem is that the other institutions of accountability in the government, the ones that are supposed to generate data and keep us informed, don't work very well. And of course, under the current president, a lot of the organizations that produced data, you know, ranging from the EPA to the Congressional Budget Office, have been hobbled. So we'll be seeing less and less data. The Census Bureau chief recently left. That's a disaster. It's not something we're going to go into here, but the fact is that is information that absolutely strengthens our democracy, and all you have to do is choke off the funds, and there that goes. The media can't carry that whole load. Now, I have to say that something that wasn't around in Lippman's time was data journalism and computer and digital technology. The media can pick up more than that, but again, it is expensive.
There's a cliche that used to feel like an act of resistance. It was the internet wants to be free.
Yeah.
So, yeah, on the one side, open source values versus the corporatization of the web, yes. But on the other side, journalism is dying in the post-newspaper world because the internet has no business model.
Yeah. Information wants to be free meant unfettered. It didn't mean without a price.
Let's take a call. Claire in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Brooke Gladstone. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Brian, and hi, Brooke. Thank you so much for taking my call. I really love and appreciate both your shows so much.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say, apropos of that, I mean, it's more of a sort of requote from Tocqueville, whose insight was that revolutions are sort of produced by rising expectations and improved conditions, not by mass immiseration. And so there is this subtle or not so subtle undermining, and what that means for, you know, activism and even people's just ability to act.
Well, you know, Tocqueville, he was brilliant and very quotable, but I think that we see revolutions rising expectations in the midst of declining lifestyles. So it's not that, I want what he has, we'll have a revolution. It's more that the injustice that he has, what I don't have. And often it is unjust. I mean, in our country, where income inequality seems to grow with every financial quarter, it is, you know, But amazingly enough, people have, in this country, people do believe another foundational myth that anyone, if they work hard enough, can make it, or at least enough people believe that, even though it is a myth, that that will probably forestall revolution.
Kevin in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Brooke Gladstone. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thanks for having me. I love both of your shows.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And I just had a question for Brooke. I wanted to ask, what do you see as the different realities within the Democratic Party, and, you know, meaning kind of the Bernie camp and, you know, mm-hmm. the traditional, the Hillary supporter and kind of the backlash of the Bernie or bust movement?
Well, you know, I think that there's a belief all across the political spectrum in systems. And I think that we heard from a lot of the Bernie or bust people, I'm thinking of Susan Sarandon, for instance, that if you make the system unendurable, it will come crashing down and something better, fairer will rise in its place. That's why after Bernie didn't make it, she was, you know, she said, you know, it wouldn't be so bad if there were Trump, because Trump would send everything crashing down. If Bernie can't power it through, then we'll have Trump just blow it up, which is what a number of Trump followers were saying. We've got nothing but empty promises every 4 years, and you forget about us, and we've had it. We are mad as hell, and we won't take it anymore. So there is that. But in terms of specific, I think that there were just some people who believed, and there's enough history out there to show that there wasn't enough of a progressive push among the mainstream Democratic contingent. And certainly the Clintons have had their issues. The welfare reform in the Clinton days was very bad for poor people, ultimately. And although many people believed it would be good, there were some who warned that what would happen did happen, including Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And then he was pushing on the issue of putting pressure on poor countries to buy name brand HIV drugs instead of making their generics, which was also just a sop to Big Pharma. I mean, you could look at history and go, we can do better. But the thing is you have to balance the costs of such purity.
All right, David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I find this conversation intriguing. And all of the people mentioned, I have read two of them in particular. Walter Lippmann, I think he was right on. And I also think that Neil Postman's right on. And yet, it seems that everything has to be repeated over and over, and nothing is remembered.
I know. It is amazing. Partly because we seem to create our own worlds almost from scratch. We get some things handed down. But interestingly, one of my big discoveries was that it was Walter Lippmann who introduced the idea of stereotypes in the psychological sense. Back in the 20s, in his book Public Opinion, he said that what we do is we pick up a salient detail about a person or a group. Are they black or white? Is he a banker or a kindergarten teacher? Do they live in Brooklyn or Baton Rouge? And then we blithely fill in the rest of the blanks, and we think that we know them. And our worldview is built on bedrock of precisely these stereotypes, not just about people, but also about ideas. We can't live without them. The world, as Lippmann said, is altogether complex, too complex for us to understand in its entirety. So our lives are engaged much more in filtering out information rather than integrating information.
So it was Walter Lippmann, a journalist, rather than Freud or somebody who came up with the idea of stereotypes?
Yeah. And he said that stereotypes, they focus and feed on the familiar and what is exotic, and they exaggerate both. So if you see somebody who's a little bit like you, for your purposes of stereotyping, they are exactly like you. And if you see somebody who's kind of different from you in a particular way, then you think they are entirely different from you. And these notions are constantly refreshed, sometimes by close, genuine observation, and sometimes by completely false analogy. And we walk around with these things. I think another term for them, these shortcuts, is heuristics. They enable us to negotiate our world. And without them, we would be paralyzed.
So to exemplify this idea, I pulled a clip from On the Media from way back in 2006
wow.
that you refer to in the book. It's it's you with Emory University professor Drew Weston mm-hmm. on selective outrage and how it flows from our stereotyping of other people. And Weston, in this one-minute clip, is describing people's brains when people they either agree with or disagree with politically say something scandalous or threatening.
The first thing that was activated were a series of negative emotion circuits that were basically, for any of your listeners who can remember Lost in Space, it was Will Robinson, danger, danger. They saw danger. They saw threat. And you could see it all over their brains. Then what you saw was activation in the part of the brain called the anterior cingulate. It monitors and deals with conflict. So you could see that they were in conflict. They were trying to figure out a way out of that conflict. And then you saw, after they had come to their conclusion that there was really no problem for their guy, what you saw was activation in parts of the brain that are very rich in the neurotransmitters that are involved in reward. These are the circuits in the brain that get activated when junkies get their fix.
You mean once they figured out how best to lie to themselves, they got a blast of oxytocin or something?
Very, very close. That's right. So they got this huge blast of dopamine, which is involved in reward.
In other words, the same thing you get when you take Coke.
That's exactly right. There was no reasoning at all going on.
So that was when somebody who is in your political party.
Right. When they say something that you really suspect is dishonest or sleazy, you know, if somebody who's not in your party does that, your reasoning sections in your brain light up. But if somebody in your own party does that, the distress area lights up. And until you figure out how to either dismiss or integrate this material in some sort of way, you will be in horrible distress. Once you integrate it or you figure out how to dismiss it, you lie to yourself, then you get your shot of dopamine. We are wired to lie to ourselves to keep our worlds consistent. That's the point.
That's the trouble with reality. Levi in Brooklyn, a psychologist. You're on WNYC. Hi, Levi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
You know, there's a saying, a famous saying. I see it all the time when I'm dealing with individuals. There's his truth, there's her truth, and then there's the actual truth, you know? And I think you personify that greatly, especially with your guests on the show talking about the psychological aspects and background of confirmation bias. And I agree with it 100%. I just have a trouble, and I think everyone has this issue, where how do we come to a realization of real objective truth when all we're doing is we're hardwired to see our way? So take the liberal media. They are saying that Trump is a less than ideal candidate, no question. But everyone still called that Hillary Clinton would win the election, and that was, in one word, two words, confirmation bias. But we're not having those conversations from both angles. So there's selective moral outrage at the right, but where is the selective moral outrage at the left? And people know this. People recognize this, and that's why I think we're so fractured.
Yeah. No, that is the fundamental problem that I try and – well, first of all, I lay out why it's the way it is in the book. And then I talk about how Trump was able to take advantage of that. And then towards the end of the book, without being too prescriptive, I try and point people to a potential, the beginning of the solution, which is simply to venture out and start listening to what other people are saying, Not to agree with it, just to know what they're saying so that your reality doesn't get overturned all over again.
Let me reset for a second. Our guest is the host and managing editor of On the Media, Brooke Gladstone, who has a new book called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. And this is an 87-page essay that's, you know, it's a little book that you can practically read on one long subway ride, but in which Brooke draws on the wisdom of so many cultural and literary figures from the last few centuries. Hannah Arendt, who we were just talking about before, Walter Lippmann, who we were talking about, George Orwell, Philip K. Dick, Ursula K. Le Guin, Jonathan Swift, and we'll get to the Gulliver's Travels references with which you end the book in a little while, to name a few, to help us understand what the heck is going on with this twisted moment in our history after the election of Donald Trump.
You know, I was told by a number of people who have read the book that although there isn't a solution and I'm not trying to calm anybody down, just placing this moment in a historical perspective offers a kind of consolation. You realize we've been here before as a species, even as a nation, and the Republic survived. So there's that. I have that going for me anyway.
I had that experience reading the book too. It's somehow at once comforting and activating to see the intellectual context and the deep thinking that you did and research to give us the deep historical, sort of the intellectually historical or the history of political philosophy that underlies why we are right now. It's not a funny moment, but I think it's important to remember, this is just my opinion, that, you know, at the darkest moments of Soviet totalitarianism, humor was a main bulwark against the state for both the psychological survival of individuals and their families and for resistance. So I think, you know,
and we're a long way from there, but it's certainly true. Giving up humor, I mean, doesn't that mean then that your opponents, whoever they may be, win?
Anyway, you conclude this book by saying activism is not enough. You have to travel out of your moral comfort zone into the world of others. And after your book has referenced all these cultural touchstones, Orwell, Hannah Arendt, John Adams, Ursula Le Guin, Walter Lippmann, Huxley's Brave New World, the final cultural reference in the book is Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift. Why Gulliver's Travels, and that we are the irrational Yahoo people from that story, not the the logical horses of that story, governed by reason.
Mm-hmm. It was trying to understand the value in what we do in our world creation, that we can't live as the horses did, the hermonymes or whatever their names were, these gloriously rational horses that had really no familial feeling, no religion, no art, no storytelling, no vanity. They were pure rationality, and it's a cold, cold life. They never reflected on their lives. When it was time to die, they trotted off to die, and that was that. Humans don't live that way. They have to weave the seen and the known with the unseen and the unknown to create a more complete world. And the Yahoos were the most primal lizard-brained id Cro-Magnon type expression of that. They were nothing but impulse. It was like the whole human being divided in two parts. And then there was a third inhabitant of the realms that Gulliver traveled that I'd completely forgotten about, which were the Laputans. And these were philosophers of science who lived on an island floating in the sky. And literally, they can't see straight. One eye is focused up, one eye is focused down. And they had to hire people to gently strike them on the mouth. strike the mouth of the man who was supposed to speak and the ear of the one who was supposed to listen and to hold on to his master so that he didn't just walk into the street or fall down a hole because they were so detached from the world in their speculations. And they didn't know how to work in the world at all. They built lopsided homes, clothes that didn't make sense. They were so oblivious to the results and so smugly insured of their own superiority that they were both quite brilliant and quite stupid. And that's what happens when you focus on abstraction and systems and don't continually refresh your view of the world that you actually live in, which means stepping out of the unseen creation into what you can see, and not just what you can see around you, but what you, with the help of our endless media, our boundless ability to peer elsewhere, read into the minds of other people who are so utterly foreign to you.
And that's ultimately in this rumination that your book is on unshared realities that strikes many pessimistic notes.
Mm-hmm.
You conclude that there is a path, maybe not to agreement, but at least to comprehension. And so the last line of your book is, if we really look, we might see that other reality reflected in that person's eyes, and therein lies the beginning of the end of our reality problem. So you're not such a pessimistic fatalist after all.
Hey, I mean, you have a choice. You can give up or you can keep striving. I mean, all of the people who are calling in saying we must resist must understand that there is an external resistance, but there's also a resistance one can wage against one's own smug surety, our own tunnel vision. Not that it even has to change you, but so that you really know what you're fighting against and how best to know what you're fighting for.
We just have 2 minutes left. How did you manage to write this book?
In 2 weeks?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously since the election, since the inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't start
it until February. Workman Publishing gets a lot of credit. They suggested that On the Media do something. And I said, there's not a thing that we could do over a length of time that wouldn't come out until the fall. And by then, the country will have changed 100 times over. We have to get this out in the spring, which means I finished it in March. So it was a very fast turnaround. It was kind of a fever dream. Basically, I wanted to address those anxious, gut-wrenching feelings that I would occasionally have until I could compartmentalize them for the work. Then I let Bob experience those feelings instead.
Your co-host, Bob Garfield.
But this whole thing was to stare it down. And the way that I do that is to step away, as far away as I can get, and look at it from a distance and see where it fits in to everything else we know about ourselves.
So, Brooke, congratulations on an amazing accomplishment.
Brian, I'm so grateful that you liked it so much. I can't tell you.
I really love it. And I really do think it's, you know, it's intellectually deep and inspirational, emotionally and sort of culturally enlightening, all of those things at the same time.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us. We conclude this morning with our interview with John Waters about his recent commencement address that went viral and is now a book. It's probably a little different from what President Trump told the Liberty University graduates. Remember, we might not be able to take your calls today, but you can always continue the conversation on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC, or on the website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. On WNYC. So we're about a month away from all those ceremonies at colleges around the country when distinguished persons from various fields will offer guidance based on experience to newly minted graduates. But who gets picked to speak? Well, how are these for qualifications? Quote, I was suspended from high school, then kicked out of college in the first marijuana scandal ever on a university campus. I've been arrested several times. I've been known to dress in ludicrous fashions. I've also built a career out of negative reviews and have been called the Prince of Puke by the press. And most recently, a title I'm really proud of, The People's Pervert, unquote. Well, that would be John Waters, the filmmaker, actor, writer, and visual artist whose commencement address to Rhode Island School of Design students in 2015 went viral, as some of you know, and has now been illustrated and published in book form with the title Make Trouble. And he's here in studio to offer more wisdom. Welcome back to WNYC, John Waters.
Thank you very much.
Which of your movies was it that got you the title Prince of Puke?
I think that was an editorial in the Baltimore Sun when there was a reaction against the Baltimore Museum giving me a retrospective before Hairspray, before I was in any way thought of as respectable, using taxpayers' money. And they gave me a great editorial saying the Baltimore Museum should do this. So that's where my title, that one, came from.
There you go. Pedigree. I should point out that the Rhode Island School of Design, or RISD, is a pretty special place that celebrates iconoclastic thinking. Its graduates include David Byrne and other members of Talking Heads, plus Seth MacFarlane, Shepard Fairey, Kara Walker, to name a few. Was this your first commencement address?
Yes. Well, actually, once I taught in prison, and I spoke at that graduation in the yard in Patuxent Institute between Baltimore and Washington. But it was a real degree. They got through what was then known as Community College of Baltimore. So they gave me a lifetime thing, which just means you're crazy and smart and got publicity. And they give you a degree so I could teach. So that was maybe, but I wasn't the commencement speaker. So, but I definitely was. I never graduated from anywhere. So I didn't even know what that was. I never saw one.
Your speech was aimed specifically at artists, people who, like you, might want to avoid working for someone else in an office at all costs. You say, a career in the arts is like a hitchhiking trip. All you need is one person to say, get in, and off you go. But then you add, and then the confidence begins.
Yes.
Were you suggesting that you can't wait until you're feeling confident to do things?
Well, somebody has to like you. You from the very beginning, I had an audience. They might have been tiny and it might have been crazy, but they were supportive. When kids come to me at colleges, and I travel to colleges a lot because I do a spoken word show, they always say, how can I be a filmmaker? I thought, if you have to ask me that, you won't be one, because you have to think, I'm going to be, and how am I going to do it? And everybody will say no. No, 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 until you get one yes. And then once you get yes and you do it, the confidence does begin because someone believes in you. Someone besides your parents have to believe in you.
You also managed to sort of slip in there that you might be the Prince of Puke, but you get up and work at 6 a.m. every day. As you put it, if I didn't work this hard for myself, I'd have to go to work for somebody else. What's the mix of inspiration and perspiration for you?
Well, to me, I like my work. So when I jump out of bed, I'm Monday to Friday. I'm not a workaholic. I have a personal life. I go out to eat. I do what everybody else does. But I like to work, and I found something. For me, in the morning, I have to think up weird things. In the afternoon, I sell it. It's a basic work day. And I work longer than 8 hours a day. But I work for myself. And as I say in the book, I can go to work in my underpants in the room right next to my bedroom and think and write. And there's nothing wrong with working in an office. When they say that, I don't think that's wrong. And some people love that and some people are good at that. I wouldn't be good at it. I recently got a new office and I still don't go to it. All the people that work for me go there every day, but I still work in my office at home.
Is it a risk for young artists to think that they should wait for inspiration to strike more than getting up and starting at a specified time?
Well, if they're already think of themselves as artists, and I hate that when I meet people and they say, I'm an artist, I think, I believe I'll be the judge of that, or history will be the judge of that. You are not the judge of that. If they have to wait for inspiration, they aren't an artist. They've already had some inspiration to decide they want to be an artist in the first place, don't you? How many people say, I want to be an artist, but I have absolutely no idea what I should do? Not even a fantasy.
Let's take a call. Michael in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with John Waters. Hi, Michael.
So I'm curious, in that no phase, if you could tell us a little bit about what you did just to support yourself and, like, maybe different jobs you had to take during the no phase until you get that yes?
Yeah. Well, actually, I worked in a bookshop in Provincetown, the Provincetown Bookshop, and I loved working in a bookshop. You meet smart people. I had really good bosses. I got thrown out of every school, so my education really did come from the Provincetown Bookshop. But that bookshop closed every summer, every winter, because it was only open the summer, so I got unemployment. So, you know, unemployment was my grant. You know, they helped me make those early movies. And then I got a job for...
Don't tell Paul Ryan that.
No, I know. And then I got a job. This is worse. I got a job for a survey company, but no one would let me in the house because I looked so freakish. So I just made up all the answers. It was really a writing exercise. And the whole interview, if I got it, was Gallup surveys, which everybody's heard of. But it took a whole hour to do this interview, and no one would ever let me in. So I just made up different ones. It was character development. Mm-hmm. So you find a way. It might not be legal, but you find a way to survive.
Michael, thank you. John Waters with us. His new book, Make Trouble, the text with illustration of a widely shared commencement address that he gave at Rhode Island School of Design in 2015. And you offer some pretty practical advice after saying, so what if you have talent? Then what? Your advice is to keep up with what's causing chaos in your own field. I think Donald Trump and Steve Bannon might have taken your advice. But what did you have in mind there?
Well, certainly, if you want to be an artist, go to the one street left in Manhattan that's a bad neighborhood, and because that's where the next big gallery wants to open. You have to participate in what you do. If you want to be a writer, you got to read. If you go to the movies, go see the movies that all flopped and see what went wrong. You've got to participate in the same field, because once you might have talent, but then what? Once you do this painting or write this book, what do you do with it? You got to know how the business works.
Luis in Jersey City. You're on WNYC. Hi, Luis.
Hi, how are you? For me, it's just a commentary. I came to this country 31 years ago with a suitcase and a dream to be a photographer. I got a lot of no's at first, no English, no place to live. 3 years later, after I arrived, I got a chance at the Associated Press and became a freelancer with AP, started working with the New York Times, got hired by the New York Post, quit my job after 20 years with the Post, became a freelancer again. And recently I did 4 books, commission work by the city of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, my original home country. And I'm still making my living now as a freelancer by working full time. But I believe in that I had something. I don't know if I have a talent.
You should tell Trump.
And hire me to do photos, to take photos.
So that's the moral of the story is, even from those humble beginnings, if you believe that you really had something, you can get there.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And you have proved Trump wrong of every single thing he says about somebody that wants to come to this country.
Fantastic. I photographed Trump several times for newspapers that I work for.
How did you focus?
Well, it was before he became like this foot in his head that would become the president. He wasn't like that. He was just like, he was a nice guy, very accommodating. And I did nice portraits. It became like front page stories for the New York Post, which I used to work for. So it's just, you have to believe in yourself. And don't let anybody tell you that you cannot do it.
Exactly. But someone had to believe in you first, which someone did. And that gave you the confidence to keep going.
Yes, right. I thought already it's what I said at the Associated Press.
Yeah, that's great. And so many people in journalism, actually, and I guess including photojournalism, got their starts at the Associated Press.
Yeah, AP.
Luis, thank you very, very much. You say in the book and in the speech, I didn't change, society did. And as evidence, your movie Multiple Maniacs, one of your first full-length features from 1970, which I admit I haven't seen, has just been included in the Criterion Collection. And there you are in a collection of the greatest films of all time, perhaps a more staid list in the past, for a movie that the essay in praise of it calls genuine trash. What has changed?
Well, what's changed is completely, I mean, my last film was A Dirty Shame, which was a NC-17 rated movie about sex addicts. My first movie was Hag in a Black Leather Jacket in 1964, an underground movie about a Ku Klux Klan guy marrying a black man and a white woman on the roof of my parents' house. That doesn't sound so different to me over 50 years. But the difference is, is that now the stuff I did so long ago in the luxury of a time capsule can be accepted completely because almost like a hostage video. You know, these kind of things were made, and people look back on them and think, wow, it's so strange. But once they can't get rid of you, they learn to accept you. I mean, I got the Writers Guild Lifetime Achievement Award this year. That was incredibly important to me. It's like being at your own funeral and getting to hear the nice things people say while you're still alive.
Fred in Bushwick, you're on WNYC with John Waters. Hi, Fred.
Hey, how's it going? I just wanted to say to Mr. Waters that he has impacted me and a group of friends more than he could ever imagine.
Oh, that's very nice. I hope in a good way. You're not in a mental institution calling me.
In the best way possible. I was like living in Washington, D.C., working at Urban Outfitters, this small group of friends who were all like artists and writers and painters. And we were so enraptured by Female Trouble, Multiple Maniacs, you name it. We would quote the dialogue from Female Trouble in our everyday conversation.
I hope not to the customers.
Oh, always to the customers. You know, so, we were Dawn Davenport was our inspiration. So, you know, and now I'm like almost 50 and I work for myself and I live here in New York and I make this great life for myself. And I have all these friends that are all those friends from Urban Outfitters are now artists and parents. And we're passing on the tradition of John Waters film to their children.
Oh, that's really great. It's really flattering to me that better than any reviews or money or anything, the best thing is continuing to get a young audience. That is something you can't buy. You can't buy with advertising. You can't buy with anything. And I've been really, really lucky to have that continue.
Fred, thank you very much. You save your best-known film, Hairspray, that's been made into a Broadway play and performed live on broadcast TV, that it is the only really devious movie I ever made, considering some of your other films. How so?
Well, because Pink Flamingo certainly is preaching to the converted. Hairspray is now playing in probably half the high schools in America, and it's two men singing a love song. They certainly wouldn't have allowed that when I went to high school. It's a musical that oddly does encourage your white daughter to date black guys, something that even right-wing Republicans like Hairspray, they don't see that it says that. So it's the Trojan horse. I snuck in my values, and it worked.
You do address some of the things that have changed on campuses, the idea of trigger warnings, for example, about which you say, I thought that's why you went to college. So are you another artist concerned about free speech on campuses?
I think you should be able to say anything, even though I when they rioted in Berkeley, I had a certain nostalgia for that. But I think let him speak. He's not dangerous. He's boys in the band, if you ask me. But
guy Milo.
Yeah. He already self-imploded anyway. But to me, I am for free speech, definitely. And I think we have to listen. Also, if you're smart, you read your enemies that are smart, what they think. That's why I do like the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I don't agree with it, but smart people write it. So you have to know how the people that don't agree with you think, too.
And one of the lines in this commencement address is, listen to your political enemies, especially the smart ones, and then figure out a way to make them laugh.
Yeah. Well, you never get anyone to agree with you or stop and think if you can make them laugh first. And I've tried to do that my whole life. I'm not a separatist in any way. I think the country is so divided right now. If we both try to make each side laugh, it would be a good start.
You say, well, when you say never be like some of my generation who say we had more fun in the 60s, you say, no, we didn't.
No, we didn't. Are you kidding? If I was 17, I'd be shutting down the government with my computer. I'd be such a hacker. I'd be like cruising on Silk Road with Bitcoin. I'd be in the deep, dark web.
Seem allergic to the those were the good old days.
No, I don't believe in that. I'm proud of my past, but I'm not nostalgic. I always think tomorrow is going to be better. What's going to happen tomorrow? I'm way more interested in the next thing that some young kid's going to come up with that startles me. That's youth's job. Shock me.
Eve in San Francisco, you're on WNYC with John Waters. Hi, Eve.
Oh, hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. So I watched a commencement speech by David Foster Wallace, and his advice was, or one thing that he said was that no one really warns you about the tedium of being an adult.
like all the time you spend in the grocery store line and time stuck in traffic. And sort of I have yet to figure out how to use that time, and I was wondering if John Waters had any advice.
Well, I like David, and I think his speech was good. I read it. But personally, I do not find it tedious to wait in the grocery store line. I look at every person. I make up instant biographies about them. I try to see what food they're buying and how it's affecting their weight. I'm interested completely by every single thing. I'm a voyeur. I love to watch people. So and now in a traffic in the car, yes, when you're sitting there waiting, well, you then can go online. You can text when you're sitting stuck in traffic, certainly. You can make phone calls. You can catch up things you never used to be able to do when you were stuck in traffic. You can watch the biggest assholes, the people that have road rage. You can watch them. They're the biggest jerks in the world, right? But you can see them fuming. There's drama. There's always drama. So there's always something happening. You just have to watch it and then use your imagination to imagine it even better or worse.
Eve, thank you very much. I think you got some good advice there.
Thank you.
Thank you. You direct graduates to make me nervous. Who's doing that today after you've made so many people nervous?
Oh, certainly. Let me think. Like the movie Raw, which is a good cannibal movie I just saw. There's certainly new artists. There's certainly new musicians that are... I just went to see Future Islands' new record. They just had a release party, and they performed in Baltimore to a very small audience. They don't make me nervous, but it's a different kind of star, and it was great. It was like really seemed new to me, and it questioned the musical roots I have. So that's what makes me in the best mood when that happens.
We have a minute left. You were telling me off the air you spent some time in New York, Baltimore, San Francisco.
And in Provincetown. Yeah, I live in four places, yeah.
Say something about Baltimore that people don't know.
Well, Baltimore, firstly, is the only place left that's cheap enough to have Bohemia. Oh, there is new stuff going on in Baltimore. If it is in New York, I love New York, but the last good gay bar I went to was Squeeze Box. That had been open for years.
And we will have to leave it there with John Waters, author now of Make Trouble, good advice for all of us. It was the commencement speech that he gave at the Rhode Island School of Design in 2015 that went viral and is now out as an illustrated book.
By Eric Hansen, a really good illustrator.
Called Make Trouble, again, the title of the book and the speech. Thank you so much.
Thank
really
you.
Fun. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. I hope you enjoyed our Memorial Day special. We'll be back live tomorrow.